Oxford Sparks Podcast, Episode 3, There's No Place Like Home, Part 1.
It's a bird, it's about the size of a sparrow. It's got most noticeably a bright yellow underparts with a black stripe down the middle, black head with a white cheek, and a sort of greyish blue back. Very simple song. People say it sounds like a squeaky hinge on a gate. So it's not one of the world's great songsters. It's not a nightingale or anything like that.
Come join us on a stroll in the woods today. We're just outside Oxford in Whiteham Woods, a lush home to a rich ecosystem, one of the world's longest-running ecological studies, monitoring local bird populations, specifically the bird we've just been hearing about, the great tit.
It's mid-June now, which in most years, almost all of the young birds would have already fledged the nest some time ago.
This is Ben Sheldon. He's our tour guide for the day.
I'm the Luke Hoffman Professor of Field Ornithology here in the Department of Zoology in the University of Oxford. I'm also the Director of the Edward Gray Institute for Field Ornithology. We study the behaviour, ecology, evolution and conservation of birds in natural environments. The woodland we're in is on a hill. Whiteham is a hill that overlooks Oxford, just west of Oxford. At this time of year, in mid-June, the forest is quite dark and green. The leaves are fully developed and out, and it's quite shady underneath the trees. It's pretty windy today, so you can hear the wind in the treetops. Even this late in the spring, there's still lots of birds singing and birds calling, a place that feels very much like a real natural environment. And that's one of the reasons why it's been such a popular place for biologists from Oxford to carry out this sort of ecological fieldwork.
Back in 1947, an Oxford zoologist called David Lack took a great interest in the local tit population. He decided to set up a study to monitor their numbers.
In those days, people didn't understand very much about things like how long animals lived in the wild and how many offspring they had and that sort of thing. So initially, the study was really just to try and get that sort of basic data about lifespans and productivity and all that kind of stuff.
Now, nearly 70 years on, it's still going strong.
Since then, that study has continued really using very simple methods where each year we go out and we log the birds that are breeding within nest boxes distributed around that forest. We have quite a lot of nest boxes now, well over 1,200. And each year we mark the nestlings that are born each year, give them an individual ring number. So that means anytime we catch that bird again, anywhere, we know exactly where that bird was born and then who its parents were. And obviously if its parents, we might know who its grandparents were and so on and so on.
Because of their short lifespans, this study's captured data for around 35 generations of birds.
Getting on for hundreds of thousands of individuals.
In human terms, that's the equivalent of going back 1,000 years. But why this particular bird? Why not a robin or a blackbird or something?
So really it was about finding a species that is easy to study and for which it's easy to collect large amounts of data. They will very readily nest in artificial nest boxes. So they naturally breed in cavities in trees, so where there's been a hole in a tree, and that means you've got very easy access to those birds. So it's very easy, for example, to catch the birds and to ring the young and to count how many eggs they've laid and to weigh the young and all that sort of thing. That sort of thing that's very difficult to do with birds in natural nests.
Well, let's get back to Whiteham Woods, where Ben's taking us around some of the bird boxes. Let's see what we find.
Okay, so here we are checking box number 256 in Broad Oak. If we open this, we can see, oh dear, see, this is a brood of blue tits, quite large nestlings, which have all died. And what will have happened there is quite possibly one of the parents may have been caught by a predator like a sparrowhawk, so there might have been just one parent there. And one parent trying to rear a large brood of young will find it very, very hard to find enough food. So the young get hungrier and hungrier, and then eventually the young may possibly starve. Complete death of a brood is not unusual, and it's not a very nice thing to see, but it happens to a reasonably large proportion of nests each year. They fail at some stage. Sometimes they fail before the eggs hatch. Sometimes the young die very early on during development. Of course, there's lots and lots of things that will recycle those dead nestlings, and they won't, in a sense, go to waste. It's something we'll find them to eat. There's a very interesting species of carrion beetle that is often attracted to dead nestlings and will probably quite soon come and find those birds.
The average lifespan of these birds is very short, and so they're born and then they leave their nests soon after to go and set up on their own.
If you sort of think about it, there must be a lot of mortality there, otherwise we'd soon be up to our knees in great tits or robins or whatever it is.
Ben also suggested that the reason this nest failed might have been because of a lack of oak trees nearby.
There's very little oak within a close distance of this particular nest. And we know, for example, that nests that have a low density of oak trees near to them are more likely to fail at the chick stage. And that's likely to be because the other species of tree, sycamore and ash, don't support as many caterpillars as an oak tree will.
Well, let's try another box. Maybe we'll be more lucky this time.
Here's another box here. You see it's on a nice big oak tree. And if we look, open the door for this one, we can see inside that actually it's got quite a large number of rather well-grown chicks. These are about 17 days old. These are quite soon going to be ready for fledging. They look very healthy to me, all nestled in there snugly together. So I wouldn't want to take them out because they have this habit of, it's called exploding, not literally exploding, but the young all sort of leap out squeaking in different directions when they're just about ready to fledge. It's a sort of way of distracting a potential nest predator. They'll all go in different directions and the parents will also come down and mob. So this is an age where we shouldn't handle them too much because they're quite prone to do that.
Soon these chicks will be ready to make a move and set up their own home somewhere else.
And we know that in the case of a blue tit here, the average bird moves about 950 metres from where it was born, so just under a kilometre. And that's the equivalent of moving about 7 or 8 territories.
So that's not that far. I guess it's the equivalent of moving 7 or 8 houses down from your parents when you leave home. The data's also shown that males tend to settle closer to home than females do. But the time of the year that these birds choose to breed is also really important to their success.
So in years in which the oak trees come into leaf very late, which tends to happen when the spring's been very cool, that means the caterpillars tend to hatch out late.
Which means the birds need to keep in step and time their breeding a little later.
And this is a year in which all of those things happen. So trees came into leaf very late this year, the caterpillars were late and the birds were late. But provided that they're all sort of synchronised like that, then birds do relatively well. The caterpillars have got some nice fresh leaves to eat and so on.
Everything's connected. There's a strong case for synchronicity that exists within this ecosystem between the climate, the plants, the trees, and between the birds and the insects they feed upon. It all needs to be in time together in order to thrive.
People have suggested, for example, that if one part of a food chain changes in a different way than another, for example, if it gets warmer, then that breaks up that sort of synchrony between the different parts, and that could have consequences for the way that animals that rely on that food chain for food, for example, on their future viability. So we're trying to understand the linkages between different parts of food chain, the timing of the annual cycle. So the thing that fascinates me is how those birds are able to take lots of complex aspects of their environment and to use those to make what look like being the right decisions about things to do, and where to breed and when to breed and how many young to have and so on. And that's the thing that our understanding of is still fairly rudimentary, quite how it is that, you know, variation in the environment affects the neurological decisions that an individual makes. So that for me is fascinating and slightly humbling as well.
You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Chris Lintott, and produced by Ed Prosser. You can find a full list of credits and much else besides on our website at oxfordsparks.net.